Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm John Schwartz, a writer at The Intercept, filling in for Ryan Grimm on this week's episode of Deconstructed. You may have heard the term a writer's writer, which means an author who is especially appreciated by other authors who understand what it takes to produce good work. Robert Perry, who died in 2018, was a kind of reporter's reporter. He broke huge stories, uncovered some truly stunning facts about recent American political history, but he was largely appreciated by other journalists and did not get the attention he deserved from the world for a very good reason. Powerful people did not like what he reported and were anxious to make sure that you, among lots of other people, never heard about it. Perry helped break the Iran-Contra scandal and the Contras' involvement in cocaine smuggling in the 1980s. He worked for years for the Associated Press and then Newsweek, but when he found himself stymied in these jobs, he created one of the first online journalism sites, ConsortiumNews.com, in 1995. Did you know that in the early 1990s, after the fall of communism, the Russian government sent a report to the U.S. Congress telling them that Soviet intelligence had been monitoring the Reagan campaign in 1980, and the campaign had conspired with the revolutionary Iranian government to keep American hostages in Tehran until after the election? Or that Alexander Haig, Reagan's Secretary of State, told him that he, Haig, had confirmed with the Saudi crown prince that Jimmy Carter had given Saddam Hussein a, quote, green light to invade Iran in 1980? Probably not, unless you were reading the classified documents Perry was publishing on his website. During his life, Perry wrote many books, including Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, and Project Truth, Fooling America, How Washington Insiders Twist the Truth and Manufacture the Conventional Wisdom, and America's Stolen Narrative, From Washington and Madison to Nixon, Reagan, and the Bushes to Obama. On this episode of Deconstructed, I spoke to Perry's son, Nat, who edited a new collection of Perry's work called American Dispatches. It's a book that should be read by anyone who's interested in what is going on, how this country actually worked for the past 50 years, and much more. I guarantee you that if you read it, you'll be in for some pretty big surprises. Nat, thank you for joining us on Deconstructed.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start by telling a story of your father's that, to me, kind of explains everything about the U.S. foreign policy blob in Washington, D.C. And the blob, as people may know who are familiar with the term, includes not just the sort of official members of the foreign policy establishment, but also the people at the top of the U.S. media. And this is something that your dad described happening right after he had started working for Newsweek in 1987. And it's in the middle of the Iran-Contra scandal. Congress is investigating the fact that the U.S. government, the Reagan administration, had sent arms to Iran and taken the money and turned around and given it to the Contras attempting to overthrow the government of Nicaragua. And your father went to a dinner at the home of the Washington bureau chief of Newsweek, Evan Thomas. And as your father said, the invited guests of honor were retired General Brent Scowcroft. This is not something your father said, but people may remember him as one of the closest advisors to President George H.W. Bush, Bush number one. Scowcroft had been one of the three members of the Tower Board, which had just completed an initial investigation of the Iran-Contra arms for hostages scandal, and Representative Dick Cheney, the ranking Republican on the House Iran-Contra panel. At the time, a key question in the Iran-Contra scandal was whether Reagan's National Security Advisor, Admiral John Poindexter, had informed the president about the diversion of profits from arms sales to Iran to Reagan's beloved Contras. As the catered dinner progressed, Scowcroft piped up, "I probably shouldn't say this, but if I were advising Admiral Poindexter and he had told the president about the diversion, I would advise him to say that he hadn't." I was startled. Here was a Tower Commission member acknowledging that he really wasn't interested in the truth after all, but rather political expediency. Not familiar with the etiquette of these Newsweek affairs, I stopped eating. "General," I said, "you're not suggesting that the Admiral should commit perjury, are you?" There was an awkward silence around the table, as if I'd committed some social faux pas. Then Newsweek executive editor Maynard Packer, who was sitting next to me, boomed out, "Sometimes you have to do what's good for the country."
So that was
their view of what's good for the country. What was your father's view of what was good for the country?
Well, I think my father had this sort of old-fashioned sort of Boy Scout view of journalism that, you know, the job of a journalist is to find things out and go tell the people. And, you know, sort of this old-fashioned idea of, you know, let the chips fall where they may and let justice be done though the heavens fall, that sort of attitude. He came from this the tradition of the 70s with, you know, the Watergate press corps and coming out of the Vietnam War era where, you know, I think at that time people really just had no inclination to really believe anything that the government was telling them. And journalists really had a skeptical view of Washington and they weren't particularly inclined to believe what they were being told. But that sort of changed in the 1980s, you know, a lot of the pressure that the Reagan administration was bringing to bear on editors and journalists. And he saw this shift in the way that journalists covered these things. And at the time, he started at the Associated Press, and that's where he broke a lot of his important stories on Iran-Contra and Contra cocaine. And even in that environment, he found it somewhat oppressive and the editors didn't always, you know, want to go out on a limb with some of these stories, but he found that eventually they would publish his articles. One time it was done by mistake. And another amusing anecdote from that era was when he broke the story of the Contras trafficking cocaine. He and his partner, Brian Barger, were the first to report on that. And, you know, they had developed, I think, something like 24 sources by that point. They had, you know, people on the record, government documents, and, you know, pretty much all of the documentation you could hope for. And they had this good story ready to go. And at the last moment, the Associated Press editors decided to kill the story, but it had already gone down to the Latin America wires and was translated into Spanish and was inadvertently published in Spanish language newspapers. And so the English AP wire sort of ran to catch up and, you know, put out the story in the American press. And so, you know, it's sort of a, you know, amusing anecdote, but, you know, that was sort of how things went, you know, during that period in the 80s, a lot of pushback from editors and, you know, a lot of fear of, you know, coming under pressure from the administration. But then, you know, he went to Newsweek. So that was the environment at the AP, which, you know, he found was already somewhat difficult. And, you know, a lot of the stories he was working on ended up, you know, causing some friction with his superiors. And so he went onto Newsweek and thought that that might be a better environment. But then I think soon after he ended up at Newsweek, that's when they had this catered dinner that the story that you just told of Maynard Parker bellowing out, you know, sometimes you have to do what's good for the country. And he realized then he was in a very different environment than he expected. You know, he always sort of described the AP as sort of a working man's news bureau, but you get to Newsweek and it was a very different environment. You know, this dinner that he played out, the story that you told, it was a catered dinner with tuxedoed waiters. And, you know, so it's just a very different environment. And what he came to sort of realize at this point was that, you know, he was in a different world than he thought he was. And that, you know, there wasn't this adversarial relationship that he thought was the way things should be between journalists and people in power, but that they were sort of sitting at the same table and both sort of interested in sort of shaping conventional wisdom and maybe not telling the full story to the American people.
Yeah, I think we should go back for just one second and emphasize again that AP broke this story, this enormous story by your father and his partner about the Contras funding themselves with sales from cocaine by accident against their own wishes.
Yeah. I mean, that's how it came to be. I mean, I don't know all the details, but basically he had filed this report and thought that it was good to go. And then he and Brian were told, yeah, sorry, we're not going to run this. You know, they probably got some pushback from the Reagan administration. Maybe they called someone in the White House and was told, like, ah, this is, you know, this is nonsense, or you know, Robert Perry's crazy, you know, da da da. But then it went out by accident. And that's how that was published, because they scrambled to put out the English version. So they, just to sort of save face. But yeah, I guess it was sort of an embarrassing episode for them. But I think one thing that, you know, is also worth pointing out about that episode was that even though this is probably one of the biggest stories of the 80s. I mean, when you think about at the time, there was the Just Say No campaign. I mean, cocaine was a big deal. I mean, like, you had the crack cocaine explosion and, you know, inner cities being just devastated by this, you know, this epidemic of crack cocaine. And, you know, you had the Reagan administration pushing this Just Say No campaign, and Nancy Reagan was out there, you know, doing these events and all this stuff.
Not long ago in Oakland, California, I was asked by a group of children what to do if they were offered drugs. And I answered, just say no.
At the same time, the government's turning a blind eye to cocaine trafficking, which is probably the kindest way of putting it. You know, in some cases, like, they may have been more deeply involved than just turning a blind eye. But, you know, they at the bare minimum, they kind of looked the other way as this was happening. But, you know, even so when the AP put that out, you know, accidentally or inadvertently, it wasn't really followed up. I mean, I think that was one of the things that my dad always found very frustrating about reporting in the 80s and breaking some of these stories, is that he was often just, you know, out on a limb. When you break a story like this, what you want to happen is for it to have legs, you know, and like for other media outlets to follow up. But, you know, the Washington Post didn't touch it. New York Times didn't touch it. You know, it was, you know, the AP kind of on its own that published this article. And it did lead to a congressional investigation. John Kerry, as I guess he was chairman of the Subcommittee on Foreign Relations, but he started an investigation in the mid to late 80s. It went on for a couple of years. They uncovered a lot of really important details about this whole operation and something called the Arms Supermarket, which was involved with the drug trade and arms trafficking and all that. But even that was somewhat ignored. And, you know, John Kerry's investigation never really got the attention it deserved until maybe a decade later. Then the whole Gary Webb series came out and it got new life.
There are documents which we've obtained independently from BCCI that confirm a participation in planned arms deals. And while some of these deals may have been aborted in the end, they do appear to have been negotiated with important Iran-Contra figures like Adnan Khashoggi and Manoucher Gurbanifar, who is the arms merchant used by Oliver North and the NSC for negotiations with Iranian moderates.
Yes, and I think it's worth remembering that Newsweek, I don't know whether your father was still working there or not, or whether he'd left by that point, referred to John Kerry for investigating this as a Randy conspiracy buff.
Yeah, that's right. That was what, my dad used that line quite often when he would write about his experience at Newsweek. You know, he was fond of telling the story of how they would call John Kerry a Randy conspiracy buff. So, you know, it kind of goes to show the mentality they had towards some of these very important stories. I mean, to me, like that whole Contra cocaine story and later what Gary Webb did with his reporting on it. I mean, how the media treated that and how they continue to sort of, you know, pretend like it didn't happen, or that, you know, Gary Webb was, you know, crazy, or, you know, that this was just a conspiracy theory. I mean, that really kind of shows to me, you know, where the limits are for what the media can cover. I mean, in some ways they do, you know, the New York Times will break some important stories here. There, you know, there'll be some exposés on things. And so, you know, it's not like they do a bad job on everything, but when you look at some of those stories like Contra cocaine, it really shows the limits of what is just beyond the pale for them and where they sort of draw the line.
The most incredible thing about the Contra cocaine story is not even the fact in and of itself, but to me, you would look at this situation and be like, of course we're protecting cocaine traffickers, because the New York Times itself had covered in depth the fact that we had been, you know, working closely with heroin traffickers during the Vietnam War.
Right.
Mm-hmm. More recently in Afghanistan, the New York Times ran big stories about how closely we were working with Hamid Karzai's brother, who is the biggest heroin trafficker in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And so, like, of course that happens. Like any government trying to run an empire, like the U.S., is going to end up allying itself with people who are getting money from anywhere they can. And that is going to always include drugs. And so it shouldn't be a surprise. It should be something that people should have expected. But instead, it was seen as this, you know, preposterous nonsense. And, you know,
that's a good point.
As you say, the context was that George H.W. Bush was giving a speech about the scourge of drugs, where he held up a bag of cocaine that he claimed had been bought across the street from the White House.
This is crack cocaine, seized a few days ago by drug enforcement agents in a park just across the street from the White House. It could easily have been heroin or PCP. It's as innocent looking as candy, but it's turning our cities into battle zones, and it's murdering our children. Let there be no mistake. This stuff is poison.
It was crazy. So, of course, it was a huge story, but it also should have been expected.
Yeah.
And your father did a great job, you know, covering it, not just at the time, but continuing, as you say, with Gary Webb, where Gary Webb sort of rebroke the story in 1996.
Yes.
And then faced, you know, total career destruction and very sadly later committed suicide.
Yeah. And one of the things my dad was fond of pointing out about Gary Webb and was his contribution to this bigger picture, not just by his reporting, which was substantial and filled in a lot of details about what happened to the cocaine once it arrived in the U.S. and how it fueled these drug gangs and all that. But it led to a CIA investigation, which essentially confirmed a lot of the details, you know. And of course, the executive summary kind of would contradict the actual content of the Inspector General's report. But, you know, as someone who would read all these reports cover to cover, my dad found that the content of the reports actually did confirm a lot of what Gary Webb had reported and what my dad had reported and filled in a lot of the details there. So, I mean, they, you know, despite the fact that the media treated Gary Webb as a pariah and destroyed his career and, you know, sadly led to him committing suicide, he actually, his reporting was vindicated in many ways by the CIA's own investigation.
Gary Webb, are you there this morning?
Yeah, I am.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you?
Very tired.
Tell us, you know, in a couple of minutes, what this is about.
It's about a drug ring that operated in San Francisco and Los Angeles in the mid-'80s. And it was connected to a Nicaraguan anti-communist army called the FDN, which was one of the biggest groups that we know as the Contras. And it was selling cocaine in Los Angeles, for the most part, but in other areas of the country as well, to the gangs, to the Crips and Bloods, down in South Central Los Angeles. And they were taking the money and using some of it, I don't know how much, we haven't figured that out yet, to buy weapons for the Contras.
Yeah, so I would just say for anyone who's curious about this, get American Dispatches. There's a ton of it in there. Or you can just visit the CIA website, which really does have its own investigation of what happened and includes some pretty startling details.
That's right.
So next, I wanted to ask you about your father's long years of work on trying to uncover the history of the 1968 presidential campaign and whether or not Richard Nixon had actually conspired with the Vietnamese government, the South Vietnamese government, to keep the war going. And this was, as with the Contra cocaine story, an example of how valuable the work your father did was, because he would keep at things literally for decades. And as more and more history dribbled out, he would take it and, you know, put it in context and explain exactly what it meant. So what was the story in 1968?
Well, I mean, President Johnson was negotiating in Paris for an end to the Vietnam War in 1968. And it looked promising in terms of reaching some kind of peace agreement to end the war. But Nixon's campaign sort of went behind the back of the Johnson administration and through back channels sort of promised more favorable deal to the North Vietnamese when Nixon was elected. And of course, when he was elected, there was no secret plan, you know, to end the war, but it was just escalated and tens of thousands of additional Americans died and who knows how many Vietnamese. But yet it was a story that my father covered for decades and through a lot of FOIA requests and visits to the Nixon library and just digging for decades, I really uncovered a lot of details, including something about the Wall Street insider trading that kind of, and this is one story I included in the Reader American Dispatches. I wanted, because he did a lot of reporting on this story in the mid 2010s, sort of when he was really writing about this a lot. But, you know, I definitely wanted to include something in the Reader about this story, because it was a very, very important story. But I found that most of the articles he wrote were, you know, very long form, and he went into a lot of detail, and, you know, compiling a big Reader like this that ended up being 700 pages. I was really like looking for brevity as much as possible. So the article I chose on this was about the Wall Street insider trading, because I guess some people on Wall Street knew of what Nixon was up to, and knew that the war was going to be prolonged, and they were, you know, profiting off of this insider knowledge. So that's something he uncovered probably in 2014 or so. But yeah, that's sort of the gist of it. But it's sort of a precursor to the 1980 October surprise, where the Reagan campaign went behind the back of the Carter administration. It was trying to free hostages in Iran, and that's a whole nother story that he pursued for decades. But yeah, sort of very similar kind of dynamic.
Yeah, and the significance of the 1968 story and the Nixon campaign is, again, not just the facts in and of themselves, but if you know, as we now do, and in fact, you can read about it in the New York Times about Nixon absolutely did do this, absolutely did conspire to prolong the war, is that once you know that one campaign did do this already, it casts a different light on the story of what happened in 1980. Again, a story that your father pursued for years, for decades, and uncovered truly extraordinary facts. So let's talk about that for a little bit. Set the stage for the 1980 Reagan campaign.
Sure. Well, as we all know, there was a revolution in Iran in 1979. Islamist radicals took over, and when they overthrew the Shah, they also seized the U.S. embassy in Tehran, and they wanted documents, I guess. I think that was the main goal of seizing the embassy. They wanted to prove what the CIA was doing in Iran and backing the Shah and all that. But they had these American hostages that they held in the embassy for, I believe, 444 days in total. And this was really like the story of 1980. It was covered every night on the nightly news. I mean, I don't personally remember it. I was only 4 at the time, but you know, is if you go back and look at sort of archival footage, you see they had a daily count on the nightly news channels, like a day, you know, 76, day 77.
Good evening. The American embassy in Tehran is in the hands of Muslim students tonight. Spurred on by an anti-American speech by the Ayatollah Khomeini, they stormed the embassy, fought the Marine Guards for 3 hours, overpowered them, and took dozens of American hostages. The students want the deposed Shah returned to Iran for trial.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw bound and blindfolded, are now beginning their sixth day of captivity inside the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. It's Friday morning there now. But throughout this night in Washington, officials will continue their search for some way to negotiate the hostages' freedom.
I think on one show, I'm trying to remember whether it was Nightline or somewhere else, like, you know, the name of their segment was always America Held Hostage.
Yeah. So it was a big deal, and it was destroying Jimmy Carter's reelection chances. You know, there were other factors, the economy and various, you know, the whole stagflation and national malaise at that time, but this did not help, you know. And so what they were hoping for was an October surprise where they might free the hostages right before the election. And that was sort of the original October surprise. Like, that's when the term was coined. And nowadays every election has an October surprise or an expected October surprise, but that was the first one. And I think that term was actually coined by William Casey, who was the campaign director for Ronald Reagan in 1980 and would later become CIA director. He's an old spy master. He was in the original OSS, the precursor to the CIA. So, you know, he'd been in the CIA for a very long time, and he was the campaign director for Ronald Reagan. And the allegations actually came up as soon as the election happened. There were already suspicions because on the day of the inauguration, after Reagan defeated Carter, within minutes of Reagan being sworn in, the hostages were freed. And so there were always some suspicions that there was something that went on there between the Reagan campaign and the Iranians to hold the hostages there until the election to ensure that Carter was defeated. My dad sort of discovered a lot of the details when he was covering Iran-Contra, because these networks that were being used in the mid-80s for transfers of arms from the U.S. to Iran as part of this whole operation to illegally fund the Nicaraguan Contras, these networks were established much earlier, which is what he was beginning to discover. What he was hearing this, you know, from his sources, like in the mid-80s, because most people assume that these networks were established at the time, like in 84, 85. But what he was being told was that they went back to 1980, when the Reagan campaign undercut Carter's hostage negotiations, which, by the way, you know, I would say is treason. You know, if you're going behind the back of the president to undercut his foreign policy and to hold Americans hostage, you know, for political gain, I mean, I think that would pretty much fall under any definition of treason. And so his first book was, his second book was called Trick or Treason, about the October Surprise Mystery. So he was actually recruited by PBS Frontline to produce a documentary about this in the early 90s. So what it all came down to, you know, there were these allegations that there were secret meetings in Paris and Madrid between the Reagan campaign and the Iranians. But the defense that the Reagan people would give is basically they would give alibis, like say, oh, well, William Casey couldn't have been there because he was at this conference in London. And so my dad went on this multi-continent investigation, you know, trying to solve this mystery and pursuing all these alibis and finding out that none of the alibis held up. And, you know, he wasn't at the conference in London. He wasn't at the Bohemian Grove and all these other places where he was supposed to be. But he never really proved that it happened. All, you know, at the time, really what he proved was that, you know, the alibis didn't hold up and that there was always this possibility that these meetings took place. But then later, after publishing Trick or Treason, he uncovered a bunch of documents from the House investigation into this matter that took place in 1992. And it was during the transition between the Bush administration and the Clinton administration that they hastily wrapped up this investigation and had all these boxes of files they kept in a storage room. It was an old ladies' room that was converted into a storage room. And he sort of surreptitiously copied a bunch of classified files that weren't really meant to see the light of day, that really provided strong evidence that, you know, that this did happen. And one of the strongest pieces of evidence was this Russian report from the Russian intelligence services that confirmed a lot of these allegations, but much of this evidence was suppressed and kept from the American people.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
After years of fine print contracts and getting ripped off by overpriced wireless providers, if we've learned anything, it's that there's always a catch. So when I heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan, I thought, what's the catch? But after talking to them, it all made sense. There isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online. They cut out the cost of retail stores and pass those sweet savings directly to you. With Mint Mobile, you save money and get quality service. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/deconstructed. That's mintmobile.com/deconstructed. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/deconstructed. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabyte on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
My favorite part about that story is him going down into the basement, going down to this former bathroom where all the reports are being stored, because he was like one of the only people in Washington who was actually interested in reading this report. Yeah. And the security guard was like, or the staffer, whoever it was like, oh yeah, they're in the bathroom, go look in there. And he went inside and opened up one of the boxes, and he was expecting to find copies of the declassified version of the report. But instead, they'd waved him into this bathroom that held copies of the classified version.
Yeah.
That he was absolutely not supposed to have access to, and just quietly copied some of these pages, including, as you say, the report from Russian intelligence saying that, yes, absolutely, this did happen. Here's where it happened. Here's who was involved. And so you found the Russian government saying this. You found the head of French intelligence at the time, who was very conservative and close to the Bushes. You found Yasser Arafat, like all of these people who were involved in like top level international politics said, yes, this happened. And I had this personal experience, you know, demonstrating that it did. Yeah. But this did not seem to be able to penetrate the consciousness of the U.S. media.
Yeah, that's right. Another good source was Ari Ben-Menashe, who was a former Israeli intelligence. And he also was an eyewitness. He said that he saw Bill Casey going into this hotel where these meetings supposedly took place. And, but yeah, I mean, he was really alone in covering this. And, you know, he knew, I think at the time, you know, this was not a career advancement opportunity. You know, it was clear that this was a story that, you know, nobody wanted. You know, it had been debunked, you know, using air quotes, you know, for debunked. I mean, essentially, the congressional investigations kind of whitewashed, or, you know, accepted all these bogus alibis. And once that congressional investigation ran its course, the media, you know, took that as a cue that, all right, this is just not a story that, you know, we're interested in. And there were a lot of stories that trumpeted the congressional debunking. And so, you know, it was the conventional wisdom was established, like, okay, this is a conspiracy theory and, you know, not something that serious journalists were looking into. And, but I guess, yeah, because of that, you know, my dad was able to sort of get access to these documents that nobody else was interested in. He actually was, another funny part of that story was that when he was in the bathroom, in this converted bathroom that was being used as storage for these files, when he discovered he had all these classified documents at his fingertips, his minder, the guy who was working in the storage facility and was supposed to be keeping an eye on him, was offering to help, but he would say, no, I got this. And apparently the copy machine he was using was some old, you know, Xerox machine that kept breaking down, and he'd be like, I'll fix it. And sort of just like, you know, trying to keep the minder at a distance. And he was also, I think, limited to something like 12 copies for each visit. So he was going there. He'd just go day after day.
And I'm just back again for this boring old material, this boring exactly old non-classified material.
Yeah, he got a lot of good material that way. And that's when he decided to start this website, Consortium News. Because even at that time, even among the alternative media, nobody was really interested in this. So he had all these, you know, important documents that he thought he could really tell a good story, write a good story about, and no one was interested in it. So that's what led him to launch his website, Consortium News, in 1995. Sort of the, like really the early days of the internet. There were, you know, anyone who kind of who remembers that time will remember there wasn't really that much on the internet. I mean, you had some like UFO enthusiasts would have some websites, and you know, you could find some interesting stuff on the internet, but you didn't have a lot of like serious journalism being done. And so he saw this as a opportunity to put this information out there. And it's sort of in a way the original WikiLeaks as well, because he published those documents in their raw form, you know, to back up his articles. So he had published, you know, a series, I think a series of 8 articles on these October Surprise X Files, as he called them, but then had the original documents there as well, so anyone could see for themselves.
Yeah, that is one of the most remarkable things about Consortium News. ConsortiumNews.com, I recommend that everybody check it out, and the extensive archives of Robert Perry's writing there. It's get American Dispatches, but there is so much more, as you say. You couldn't fit it all in one book. But I think after beating up on these Republican presidents for a little bit, we should mention one of the documents that I believe was found in that same bathroom involving Jimmy Carter, and what it said about what Jimmy Carter had done regarding Iran.
The green light, yeah. There was so these talking points that Alexander Haig prepared for Ronald Reagan in, I believe, 1981. And you might correct me if I'm getting anything wrong, but basically confirmed that Jimmy Carter had given Iraq the green light to invade Iran in 1979. Which, you know, I feel like these days we've become so jaded, and we like some of these things don't even seem that shocking anymore. I don't know. Like it seems there's so much that goes on these days that I don't know if that sounds shocking. But, you know, I guess the point is that he gave a green light to this war, and we were also providing weapons to Iraq, you know, clandestinely. And later, of course, we were supplying Iran with weapons. So we're funding, supplying both sides with weapons. That was one of the documents that he came across in the ladies' room, was this memo that confirmed that Jimmy Carter gave the green light to Iraq's invasion of Iran.
Yes. And something else your father pointed out was that when the government officially declassified these talking points from Alexander Haig.
He was Secretary of State, by the way, I think.
Yeah, that's right. He was Secretary of State, and he had just returned from his first trip to the Middle East and was reporting back to Reagan.
Right.
And finally, you know, decades later, these talking points were declassified mostly, but as often happens when some documents are declassified, sections are redacted. And 2 of the 9 paragraphs were redacted when this memo was declassified. And one of them was the one with Haig's statement about Carter. So officially, we're not supposed to know this. It's all thanks to that bathroom in the basement of the Capitol. And you know, again, the extraordinary thing about these kinds of facts is that in the United States, people are barely aware of them, if they're aware of them at all. The people who know them dismiss them as having zero importance, but to the rest of the world, they are pretty significant. The Supreme Leader of Iran gave a speech in 2009 where he specifically mentioned how America gave Saddam a green light. If Saddam did not have a green light from the Americans, he would not have attacked our borders. They imposed 8 years of war in our country. About 300,000 of our people were martyred. So people in other countries do pay attention to this kind of stuff. It's just here where we don't hear about it. And again, it's what this adds to the context of world affairs. Like if you are Iranian and you believe that Alexander Haig was correct about this, that's kind of a sore spot, you know, like if America gave Saddam Hussein a green light to attack your country, killing hundreds of thousands of people, including with chemical weapons, you know, you're going to have a certain perspective on the United States, and Americans just don't know anything about that.
That's right. I mean, it also speaks to the just cynicism of our leaders, you know, because, you know, just thinking about this, you know, the green light that Carter gave and the fact that we also clandestinely armed Iraq and Iran during this time, but you know, specifically Iraq, because I mean, this was what was used basically as justification years later. Well, originally with the Persian Gulf War, And that's another one. We gave a green light to invade Kuwait. You know, April Glaspie, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, told the Iraqis that they could basically go ahead, that we don't take a position on Arab-Arab conflicts. But then, you know, they use these incidents to justify our own wars, you know. So, I mean, just the cynicism of that, I mean, where they know that they've sort of authorized this and they've armed them, they've given them the weapons, and, you know, while it was happening, they ignored it, or they enabled it, they lied about it, and then years later, they use it as justification for our own intervention. And actually, I mean, there's so many examples of that. I mean, Noriega was another one, and, you know, the invasion of Panama in 1990. I mean, this guy was, you know, a CIA asset, you know, involved with the cocaine trade and all that. But then when he stepped out of line or became politically inconvenient, we decided to invade and take him out. And so, you know, there really is such cynicism, and just the way that they manipulate the American people, how people, you know, don't know this very important background. So it enables people to be more easily manipulated, you know, and then it just kind of goes on. And, you know, so we have another war here, and then we forget the lessons of that war, and then we go to Syria, and, you know, but I think that's what, you know, when you read my dad's writing, and hopefully when people, you know, read this reader, I mean, what comes through is that I think his growing exasperation over the years, that the lies that are told and how the American people are just manipulated constantly, and no one ever seems to learn any lessons from anything.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about sort of how he approached his work, because I think that in particular was a key thing that he understood was necessary. I think you find that in the most effective communicators, like of any political persuasion, or even just advertisers. Like, I like to quote something in a book by Frank Luntz, who is a very, you know, famous, like, sort of Republican consultant, but also does tons of consulting for just corporations on ads, as I understand it. And he wrote this book called Words That Work. It's not what you say, it's what people hear. And I think that is extremely good advice for anybody who wants to communicate with other human beings. It doesn't matter what you say if people don't hear and understand it. And Luntz said, repetition, repetition, repetition. You may be making yourself sick by saying the exact same thing for the umpteenth time, but the overwhelming majority of your customers or constituents aren't paying as much attention as you are. And that is one of the core problems to me of the US media, is that it's assumed that, like, if a story is told once, then you're done with it. And you can leave it behind forever because everybody already knows about it. Well, that's people true. Don't already know about it. And your father understood that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think even myself or you, I'm sure, you know, there are things you don't remember. I mean, somebody who pays very close attention to all these things, and you do your research, and, you know, you read and you study the history, but we don't remember everything. I think that's one of the good things about, you know, Twitter and, like, social media. Like, sometimes people will dig up some old clip or something and share it. And, like, it's like, it can be very important, you know, to see, to just refresh your memory about these things. So it is important to try to include the history when, you know, as a journalist. And yeah, don't assume that people remember everything, that, you know, it is important to go back and retell the story. I think also as a writer, you know, it helps, you know, to get back and provide the context for yourself so that you're sure that you understand, you know, what it is that you're trying to explain to the reader.
Yes, I will say I'm now getting old enough that I sometimes read things that I wrote long ago and I'd completely forgotten what I'd said. It's like, well, that was pretty interesting. Good for me in 2004. But yes, so that is part of the repetition that I think is so key that people should understand about how to approach this work, is that when you're repeating stuff, you're going back and you're telling the history again, and you have to tell the history because individual facts mean nothing to people, and they cannot even really understand the facts or hear the facts if they don't know the context for them. And so your dad was fantastic about that, about providing that context, not just here's one or two interesting facts, but here's where they fit into the larger overall story.
Yeah. I think that's a good way of putting it. I mean, he had this tendency, and this is something that was a bit of a challenge for me as the editor of this reader, you know, because he did do this so effectively, like, or, you know, always going back and reexamining stories from different angles. But, you know, I realize when you put it in a book, you know, you might not want a lot of repetition. So, you know, that was something that, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to keep enough, you know, so that it would hold the essence of each article, so that it had that the context that he felt was important, you know, for each individual article, but also keeping in mind that as a reader, you don't want to necessarily read the same thing over and over in one book, you know. But yeah, he was very fond of revisiting these themes and including a lot of history. And I think one thing that, you know, he also, as someone who was in Washington for so long and covering these stories for so long, he saw, I mean, these same people just get recycled, you know, whether it's like Elliot Abrams or, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, you know, Dick Cheney. I mean, people who were just, they've always been there, you know, in different iterations. And actually one of the early articles that I included from, I think in 1981, as the Reagan administration was taking shape, my dad wrote an article for the AP that was describing the backgrounds of all of these people that were being put in key foreign policy positions, particularly on Central America, and how the Reagan administration was going to tackle the foreign policy challenges in Central America. But all these people were Vietnam War figures, you know, generals and, you know, people who were very much involved with the prosecution of the Vietnam War. So, you know, from that point, you know, you have these people recycled from Vietnam, put in charge of Central America. And then a couple of decades later, some of these same people were then, or their proteges, you know, they, the people who cut their teeth in Central America, then were put in charge of Iraq policy, you know, and it just goes on and on, you know. And so you have to, you know, tell the full, the story of the, you know, the history, because it's oftentimes it's the very same people that are doing, that are implementing the same policies from one continent to the other. And, you know, that they're, but they're basically pursuing the same neocon agenda.
Yeah, you know, you probably know the famous quote from the Czech writer Milan Kundera about how, you know, people's struggle against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading that the first time, and, you know, he was sort of a dissident writer under the, you know, ultimate control of the Soviet regime. And he thought, oh, well, that must be awful how that happens in communist countries like that. But it is absolutely 100% true. And just remembering the past is an incredibly powerful weapon. And I think that we should make sure to put in a plug for, you know, what your father did most of all, which is reading things. Like, the amazing thing about the United States is that it really is, by historical standards, a truly open country, in the sense that you can find out what is going on, as your father did. You just have to make an effort. Like, the system doesn't make it easy for you, but if you have a library card and an internet connection, you actually can do it. And lastly, can you just tell us a little bit about your dad as a person? Certainly the impression that I get from his work was that he was modest in a really appealing sense, and that he always would say that sort of anybody could do this if you just had the willingness to put in the work. And he also was not a self-promoter. You know, he wanted to do the work and mostly let it speak for itself.
Yeah, I think that's right. I know his wife, Diane, always would encourage him to do more self-promotion. But, you know, I think he also kind of knew, I mean, there definitely was some modesty there, but I think a part of it was also, like, you know, he knew what he was good at, and he was, you know, he was a good journalist, and he was a good writer. And yeah, and I guess he did sort of feel like the work should speak for itself. And so, I mean, he was sort of, he came of age like long before social media. And I kind of wonder sometimes how he would have fared these days, where it's so much of everything is just really self-promotion and like developing a huge Twitter following. And, you know, I don't think he would have ever been particularly interested in that. I mean, maybe he would have developed a following anyway, based on his journalism. Of course, like, it wasn't completely before or after his time, but I don't know. It wasn't part of his development, I guess, as a journalist. But he had a very strong work ethic. I mean, he would, you know, work from very early hours in the morning until late at night. And I mean, I would sometimes, I live in Denmark, and sometimes I would get a little annoyed when he would, you know, come, because he was never really on vacation, even when he would, you know, take a vacation, and it would always be a working vacation. He never really unplugged, I would say. But at the same time, he's also very fun loving. You know, he had this puppet that he would entertain his grandchildren with, sort of his alter ego, this like kangaroo puppet called Kanga, and you know, very, you know, fun loving. And you know, especially when he was around, you know, his family and grandkids, you know, a lot of fun. And you know, I think he took a lot of joy in family life and sports. You know, he was a big sports fan, New England sports, you know, big Red Sox and Patriots and Celtics fan. And so he did know how to sort of unplug at times, but never really would lose sight of his mission as a journalist. And I mean, there are times though, I would say that, you know, even like, especially as he was, you know, getting older, I would sometimes encourage him to, like, you know, maybe give it a rest and try something else, you know, because you could see that it did, you know, affect him knowing what he knew and, you know, and seeing just the constant cycle of, like, you know, the manipulation of the American people and the wars that we constantly get involved in, and, you know, and Russiagate and all this stuff that he kind of could see through very clearly as someone who knew what was going on. And you know, it would get to him that that these things would just keep happening. And so sometimes I would say, you know, why don't you try something else? Like, just to, you know, maybe you could relax at this point in your life. Like, because, you know, as a big sports fan, I thought, you know, maybe you could try just writing about sports or something, you know, something a little less stressful. But I don't think that was in his nature. And, you know, he would have just continued doing it, you know, forever. But, you know, unfortunately he had this, his health went south pretty quickly in early 2018 and passed away sort of before his time in some ways. But yeah, I think he would have kept doing it as long as he could have, regardless of the stress that it might have caused him.
That was Nat Perry, and that's our show. Nat edited the new book, American Dispatches, a collection of work by his late father, Robert Perry. Deconstructed is a production of First Look Media and The Intercept. Our producer is Zach Young. Laura Flynn is our supervising producer. The show was mixed by William Stanton. Our theme music was composed by Bart Warshaw. Betsy Reed is The Intercept's editor-in-chief. And I'm John Schwartz. If you'd like to support our work, go to theintercept.com/give. Your donation, no matter what the amount, makes a real difference. Finally, if you haven't already, subscribe to the show so you can hear each new episode. And please go leave us a rating or a review. It encourages the artificial intelligence podcast gods to tell people about the show. If you want to give us feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.